Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today I want to start out the show talking about all the maneuvering going on in Congress over the $3.5 trillion so-called American Families Plan, the Sanders Plan. Then I want to get back to the theme that we initiated last week. You know, what would socialist America have to look like to be called socialist America? We talked about the changes to the economy, and I want to talk about changes to the political system that would have to occur structurally, fundamentally, in order to implement the changes to the economy and what it would look like afterwards. Okay, but let's preview this with the discussion that I mentioned about what's going on in Congress with these negotiations over the fiscal proposal here. Okay. Actually, you know, this $3.5 trillion is a catch-all. A lot of the provisions in it, like the climate change mitigation bill proposals, the education proposals, each of those are close to $500 billion. Some of the other proposals about improving Medicare, you know, introducing Medicare for dental and vision and hearing, some of the tax credits for households, child and elderly care provisions in that. They were originally in the infrastructure bill. They were called human infrastructure, you see. Originally, American Families Plan was not $3.5 trillion. It was much less, and it was mostly about family leave and a little bit of education. But when the negotiations for the infrastructure plan proposal, sometimes called American Jobs Plan, here began first early this March, those provisions were stripped out of the infrastructure plan proposal and then repackaged into the Sanders bill, we will call this, because that's what Sanders is driving it. The progressive wing in the Democratic Party is driving it. They were repackaged in this $3.5 trillion. You know, those proposals boosted the American Families Plan, and it was $3.5 trillion. And the deal was struck within the Democratic Party okay, we're stripping these out of the infrastructure proposal, but we're going to pass the $3.5 trillion. And Pelosi went along with it, and Sanders went along with it, because there was a commitment in the Democratic Party that both would be passed at the same time, or neither would be passed, you see. And that's where we are, and that's where the big debate is in the Democratic Party. Will these two proposals be passed simultaneously or not? And the progressive wing in the House and in the Senate, in the party, insist that they both be passed, because if you just pass the infrastructure bill by itself, there's no leverage there to force the centrists and the right wingers in the Democratic Party, corporate wing, and the Republicans, who won't vote for anything anyway. There's no leverage there to force the passage of the $3.5 trillion, sometimes called human infrastructure, right? And so that stripping out of those measures that were then, you know, thrown into the $3.5 trillion basket, American Families Plan, you know, was part of the stripping down of the infrastructure bill. You know, that started out $2.5 trillion initial proposal, but it was reduced. $2.5 trillion in new spending, by the way. And they engaged in all these maneuvers, you know, legislative maneuvers, and came up with the infrastructure plan proposing only $550 billion in new spending. A lot of smoke and mirrors there. You know, they took already previously authorized spending on roads and so forth, transport bill, and they threw that into the $5.5 billion, right? And then they moved some money around and proposals around, you know, that were already out there. And they added them all up, and the media keeps saying, oh, infrastructure, $1.1 trillion, $1.2 trillion bill. No, no, it's a $550 billion bill. So they reduced the infrastructure bill from $2.3 to $550 billion. And, of course, they did it by maneuvering a lot of the proposals out of that bill and saying, okay, we'll tackle that in the family's plan proposal, the $3.5 trillion. Well, why did they do that? They did that. They did what? They did that, meaning stripping the infrastructure bill down to virtually nothing over 5-10 years. They did that in order to avoid to have to raise taxes, you see. That's really the gorilla behind the scenes in these fiscal spending bills. It's taxes. How are you going to pay for this thing? Well, you know, if you got a $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill or a $3.5 trillion human infrastructure bill, families plan, then you're going to have to raise taxes, right, to pay for it, no doubt. Raising taxes means reversing the Trump massive tax cuts of 2017, $4.5 trillion, you know, not 1.9 or 2 trillion, as they say. It was $4.5 trillion. That's what the Trump 2017 tax bill was. Well, how did they get it down to $1.5 trillion that they kept saying? Well, what they did was called what's dynamic structuring, right? Dynamic means, oh, we're going to spend X amount, but we're really going to say it's lesser Y amount because we're going to assume the spending on X is going to generate the economy, and the economy is going to produce more tax revenue. And we'll take that additional tax revenue generated and we'll subtract it from the actual spending we're going to do. And then we're going to say, oh, it's only $1.5 trillion. You see, that's the game they played as soon as they passed the Trump tax bill. Right. But that was based on assumptions that the U.S. economy over the next 10 years would grow at 3.5% GDP. Every year for 10 years, and there'd be no recession. In other words, the economy would be so robust, it would generate so much spending and investment that it would generate, in turn, all the tax revenue to offset the $4.5 trillion. That's partly how they got to the $1.5 trillion. Oh, this is only $1.5 trillion. Well, as we know, it was all bullshit. And we know we had a pretty big recession. Right, and we're not going to grow anywhere near $3.5 trillion. We already had the first recession, and we'll have another one before it's over. So that assumption that the Trump tax cuts were only $1.5 trillion was nonsense. Nonsense. And in addition to that, the Trump tax cuts conveniently, grossly underestimated the actual tax cut for multinational U.S. corporations operating offshore. Grossly underestimated. Instead of those offshore, you know, biggies paying 35% profits tax or corporate tax offshore, the Trump tax cut reduced it to 10.5%. 10.5%. And that was before the loopholes, right? So U.S. multinational corporations since Trump are paying no more than 5%. If that, a lot of them are paying nothing on their overseas earnings. You see, they grossly underestimated that in the bill purposely. So if you correctly estimate, you know, the big tax cut under Trump for multinationals, and you drop this phony assumption of 3.5% GDP, then the tax cut comes to $4.5 trillion over a decade. $4.5 trillion. Well, to get back to current negotiations on these stimulus bills, right? The Republicans don't want to raise taxes to pay for them because it would mean rolling back the Trump tax cuts. You know, Biden ran on a program saying we're going to do just that. We're going to take back the Trump tax cuts. Well, you know, what are they proposing? Only a partial take back in all the measures, in all the measures. Well, which measures? Well, let's take the corporate income tax. Democrats are proposing, instead of the 21% for the corporate income tax here domestically under Trump, which was reduced from 35, we're going to raise it back to 28. That's what Biden already earlier this spring announced. Oh, you know, not 35, just 28. We're just going to raise it partially. Well, since then, it's been cut even more to 26.5%, and it'll be cut still more. What about the estate tax, the inheritance tax? You know, in decades past, you know, in early part of this century here, you know, the very wealthy, there were like 50,000 were actually only paying the estate tax, you know, and the rate, I think it was 40% or something like that. And you had to be have an estate worth several millions of dollars to even be eligible to start paying for that. So only 50,000 people were paying the estate tax. But all the cuts that have occurred and the big cut under Trump, right, only 1,900 people are paying the estate tax under the Trump tax bill. Well, you know, the Democrats, instead of saying, okay, let's go back to 50,000 of them, not 1,900, the Democrats say, oh, we're going to roll back up the tax hike on estates, on the super wealthy, to 9,000 people paying. So once again, it's an example of how the Republicans come in and they pass these massive tax cuts, whether it's under Bush or Trump. The Democrats come in, whether it's under Obama or Biden, and they take back a token amount of those massive tax cuts, right? That's been the shell game ever since Reagan. You know, massive tax cuts by Republicans, Democrats come in and they take back just a part of it. And then Republicans come back in and they cut it even bigger again, and et cetera, et cetera. And over 40 years, you get this massive reduction in taxes for the wealthy, 1% for corporations and investors. Massive. Oh, another indication of the backtracking here in the Democrats, you know, carried interest. This is where hedge fund guys get to get taxed on their profits, their takes at the capital gains rate of 20% instead of paying the 37% individual rate. You know, they get a special deal. That's called carried interest. And, you know, you can look at all the provisions of the Trump tax bill, and you can see that what's going on is just a partial token retaking back of those things, those measures. But the Republicans don't want any of that. You see, McConnell, don't touch our tax cuts, right? It's the tax cuts, stupid. You know, in the 90s, they used to say, well, it's the economy, stupid. Well, today it's all about the tax cuts or tax hikes of the Trump tax cuts, stupid. And of course, you got the corporate wing in the Democratic Party who are in lockstep with the Republicans on this. And that's why they're using Manchin and Sinema as the point persons to carry their water, you see. They don't want raising the taxes either, you know, because their buddies are big benefiting from it as well. So you got this cabal here between the Republicans, the McConnells, and the corporate wing Democratic Party don't want to raise taxes. Well, if you don't raise taxes, you can't pay for a big spending bill. That's why they cut the infrastructure bill to $550 billion. And that's why they don't want to accept $3.5 trillion here spending in the Sanders bill on human infrastructure and climate change. So you can't separate out the maneuvers on taxation from the maneuvers here on spending. But I've said in the very beginning here, before this thing heated up, that you're not going to get anywhere near $3.5 trillion if you get that. Because the corporate wing of the Democratic Party won't go along with it. And that's Manchin and Sinema. It's not an individual thing. You see, they're representing the corporate wing. And there's people in the background here that are giving them support within the Democratic Party, right? So you're not going to get $3.5 trillion. I mean, a signal of how much the corporate wing of the Democratic Party would agree is what Manchin said. Oh, somewhere between $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion. That's what I would support. Not $3.5 trillion. $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion, right? And that's what you're going to see here when this thing is over. If the progressives cave in, if Sanders caves in, if the progressive caucus in the House caves in and says, okay, let's get some things better than nothing. Elect us again in 2022, and we'll come back and we'll propose and get the rest. You see, that's what the message will be here when they eventually cave in on this thing and agree. And that's what I predict, you know. But it still will take a budget reconciliation here. You know, that's where you can vote 50% plus one. Right now, Sinema and Manchin are opposed to budget reconciliation with $3.5 trillion. And they'll agree to $1.5 trillion. They'll come on board for that. They'll get the green light from the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. It's okay to vote for that, you see. And that's what you'll get eventually. Whether the progressives in the House will agree to that remains to be seen. I think they'll cave in too. You know, it'll be the same old message we always hear from the Democrats, and that is, okay, we did the best we can. You can't get any more. We don't have the votes. Well, we're not giving up. You know, what we got to do is elect more progressives here, and we'll go at it again after we strengthen our vote and our count in the House and the Senate after the 2022 midterms, you see. That's what the message will be. Well, that's my comment on where we are here with this negotiations, which is really a negotiation not with the Republicans, but within the Democratic Party. You see, that's the blockage now. That's the problem. Democrats can't come to agreement because they, you know, the corporate wing doesn't want to raise taxes that much. Reduce the taxes, which means you'll have to reduce the spending. You know, what's likely to get more likely to get cut out of the $3.5 trillion? Well, the education provisions, which are about $500 billion. You know, we're talking over a decade here, by the way. Education provisions, you know, free community college education and more Pell Grants and so forth. Also, a big target here to be cut is all the climate change provisions. There's various, and, you know, we're talking about $400 or $500 billion there. Probably the $163 billion credits for Obamacare, you know, credits to people who are on Affordable Care Act. That's a big candidate. Also, the improvement of the investment tax credit, you know, for the poor, which is proposed for people without kids now, that'll be cut back probably. And, you know, there's other provisions there, likely family leave and so forth. Elderly care, very expensive. They won't pass that. Maybe some sort of child care will be in that, because, you know, the problem with child care is very serious in the country. People can't find child care, and it's not affordable. And that's one of the main reasons why people aren't coming back to work. A lot of them, a lot of single women just can't come back to work and leave their young kids because they can't find child care that they can afford. Okay, you know, the American Rescue Plan in March has this provision where they're paying people for child care coverage here until December. And then that goes away. What goes away already, of course, is the unemployment benefits for independent contractors, freelancers, gig workers, and so forth. 10 million out there in the labor force. That unemployment went away last week. And then, of course, the unemployment claims drop because the program's gone, right? You know, they can't get the rent assistance out there because the landlords don't want to agree to it. So that in effect has gone away. The you know, the stimulus checks have gone away a long time ago. So they're running out of stimulus. You see, they're running out of stimulus here, you know, by the end of this third quarter, as they did last year. The same thing. They ran out of stimulus and the economy lapsed into stagnation in the fourth quarter. That's what happened last year. Well, you know, if they don't get this stimulus passed pretty quick, you're going to have the same thing. We see the economy weakening already in the third quarter, and we see big problems in the global economy impacting the U.S. economy on the supply side. Supply chain problems are causing inflation to go higher than they're reporting, by the way. Yeah, they can't get the goods, imported goods, which are important as intermediate goods sometimes to produce things in the U.S., but they can't get the goods through the ports. Why? Well, one reason, the truckers. There aren't enough truckers, independent truckers, to pick up the stuff at the ports. It's a supply bottleneck. On the West Coast alone, there's 150 container ships sitting idle outside the ports. They can't get in to unload their stuff. The cost of a container has gone up from $2,500 to almost $20,000, according to importers. $20,000, right? The supply of container, world supply of container ships is insufficient, and they're bidding up the price globally for containers. So these are big supply problems. At the same time, you got the latest data shows that China has pretty much slowed down. You know, after recovering here in the first half, projections are for its GDP growth in the third quarter to be only a couple tenths of 1%. Japan is slipping into a double dip recession. All of Southeast Asia is in trouble. Australia is in trouble. The global economy is in trouble. And that can only have an impact on the U.S., right? As the U.S. in the third quarter appears to be slowing with retail sales and consumer spending and consumer sentiment down. You know, the adjusted data for 2 months ago for retail sales showed a retail sales decline of 1.8%. That's massive. Well, the latest one comes out, you know, 0.7% recovery. Well, you're going to have a little bounce back when you have that kind of a massive contraction. And you can't keep falling after 1.8% contraction for 1 month. You know, 1.8% is almost 20% cut in retail sales on an annual basis. You can't keep going at that. You're going to have a little bounce back. But with all the supply problems, you know, retail sales and COVID now, you know, raging in certain parts of the country and supply problems, you're going to have a continued slowdown longer term over several months of retail sales and consumer spending, no doubt. You know, and you end, of course, the a lot of these stimulus programs, and that takes a whack on demand as well, which causes, you know, slowdown. Okay, so supply and demand problems here aren't good for the economy. That's why Biden yesterday comes out and says we're at an inflection point. He's right, economically. We're at an inflection point. The Republicans, McConnell, want nothing more than the economy to slip back into a recession. They'll do anything they need to do in order to get reelected in 2022. They want him to fail, even though it means more hardship for the country. They don't care. They don't care. That's the scenario. That's the political scenario. And that's the situation we got with all these negotiations and maneuvers going on here in Congress over this $3.5 trillion in the infrastructure bill. By the way, if the infrastructure bill was passed tomorrow, it would have no effect near term, because that spending on infrastructure won't get into the economy until earliest mid next year. So forget, regardless of what the magnitude would have been on infrastructure bill, it's not going to have any stimulus effect here in the next 6 months or even 12 months. Right? That leaves the $3.5 trillion, which would, because of the nature of its measures, have a stimulus effect. It would jumpstart the economy, maybe even cause the temporary rebound to morph into a more... a sustained recovery here. You know, but if it doesn't get passed, then the scenario looks something similar to the fourth quarter last year. Maybe not as bad, because parts of the country that are vaccinated are opening, but other parts are not. And that's why Biden, the Democrats, are worried. But, you know, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, they only care about the wealth of their constituents, you know, that put them in office with campaign spending. You know, that's all they care about, the short term. You know, don't touch my tax cuts. You know, I like that. That's the thing I like most about Trump, right? And they're all in agreement on that, by the way, right? So you know, it's a gridlock. It's a gridlock, which isn't good for the economy, or the recovery, you know, of the U.S. economy, as the global economy looks very uneven as well. Asia's very much slowing down. Europe is recovering a little because they're all vaccinated. Other parts of the world aren't doing so good either. You know, and this stop-go is what I called a great recession, W-shaped. You know, right now we got the first V of the W, right? We got a bounce back here. But if it is a great recession, we will see another slippage and stagnation even double dip recessions coming here over the next several years. This stuff doesn't occur just, you know, in a matter of months. Okay, having said that, and spent twice as much time, you know, discussing the stimulus plans that I had wanted to. In the second half of the show, let's transition here to a continuation of the discussion I initiated last week, which is, you know, what would socialism in America look like, or have to look like, to be socialism? And last week I talked about fundamental changes in the economy that would have to occur to have a socialist economy. You know, socialism is about classes, right? Right now, capitalism is about capitalist class really rules the roost, right? Meaning the institutions, economic and political, serve its interests first and foremost. The capitalists exercise what's called hegemony over the economy and over the political system to their benefit. And of course, we see what fiscal monetary policy and institutions, pretty much the Federal Reserve giving them free money, you know, and all the other economic and political institutions serving their interests first and enriching them more and more. And what would have to happen in terms of economic restructuring would have to, you know, eliminate that hegemony by capitalists and make the working class hegemonous, right? In other words, the institutions would have to reflect its interests, and the policies would have to reflect its interests. So you got to think of socialist America is really where the working class and the policies and the institutions are primarily beneficial to the working class, not to the capitalist class. Well, to do that, as I talked about next week, a number of things initially would have to be done as a minimum. One is you'd have to nationalize certain key industries. Not the entire economy was one of the points I made last week. The key commanding heights, as they call them, you would have to fully, you know, make public, nationalize, throw out the capitalists, right, in the banking sector. You know, you'd have to have a public banking system. Oil and energy, you know, get rid of the big privatized oil companies, make them public companies, public corporations. Health insurance companies, you don't need them. They're just ripping off the whole medical system here. You go for Medicare for all. The transport system, interstate transport system, the railroads, right, local rail is already, you know, shipping and so forth. The defense corporations, no, you know, they're big ripoffs, experts here, stealing from the public trough. by overcharging massive amounts. You know, you nationalize that and make that a public industry, right? At minimum, maybe have public investment corporations, government corporations, competing with the pharmaceutical companies to reduce their prices and to make them more efficient. you know, the big six, you would have to nationalize, meaning that you drive the capitalists out of there. That doesn't mean that you get rid of their managers, you see. You still need managers to manage those companies. They are just have to be dependent upon and serve the interests of society at large, of the communities in which they operate, and their workforce. You would have to have planned economy for those major areas of nationalizations. You know, note that I'm not saying you nationalize everything, because you can't. You can't. You can't plan everything outside of those big six industries. You control the capitalists in different ways, right? You control their behavior in different ways. What other ways? Well, through the tax system and through deep regulation, non-tax deep regulation. That's how you would control them. You would also control them. I mean, the capitalists, the corporations that aren't in the big six, by setting up representation of community and the workers themselves on the board of directors of these companies, and also at the shop level committees, who will hire the managers. You know, it's not as if you're lathe operator or whatever. You know, or run the guy who runs an American control machine in the auto factory is going to make these finance decisions of the local company and operation and so forth. No, you keep the same guys there, and they work for the community and the workers in these works councils. You see, works committees. So that's another way you keep the non-nationalized capitalist in check. But you cannot nationalize, you cannot control, you cannot set prices and all the other details for these companies in the marketplace. You just can't do it. Who's going to do it, right? Do you have enough people who have the smarts to run a company? You know, you're going to send them in there, every company. Right? Do you have people in a bureaucracy who can decide how much of this piece of clothing gets produced and how much you pay for it and what the style is? No, you got to leave it to the market. You know, there'll be all, most of the economy when you introduce socialism initially will not be nationalized, will not be planned, will operate according to market forces. Right? And the capitalists will be controlled by other means. That's an important point that I made last week. Okay, but to do this, you're not going to get that kind of an economy without changing the political system as well. You know, by the way, you know, when you have that economy, you have different policies and measures in the different sectors of the economy. You change the retirement system, so Social Security it provides three-fourths of what's needed to retire. You got to raise the payroll tax. You change the whole tax system. You tax wealth and financial transactions and big businesses and corporations. You can eliminate the property tax on single homes, and you can eliminate the regressive sales taxes. You know, which boosts workers' income big time, and small businesses, right? Small businesses will actually, you know, come out better in a socialist economy than they have right now. You change the medical system, you know, Medicare for all. You change the banking system. You make the Fed a public bank, and then you establish state-level public banks and local local branch banks, or maybe post offices, whatever, and you kick the big capitalists out of the real economy. You change the education system. Tuition should be free, and you set up an equivalent to the college system we have in this country, an equivalent job training institutions throughout the country that train people for the jobs that exist now without having to have them go to college. You know, not everyone wants to go to college, but everybody needs a job, right? So you fundamentally change the education system here to educate and train more people in practical job knowledge here. Housing, you know, more public housing, retirement system, you know, reinstitute defined benefit pension plans and get rid of these phony 401ks and so forth, right? That's part of the economics of a socialist economy as well. So nationalizations, big changes in taxation and regulation, some planning, the councils, the whole council structure at the local level in businesses. You know, you would exempt small businesses from these councils, of course. You know, you want to control where the real power is in the economy. Medium, large corporations, banks, finance system, energy, and so forth. Okay, but, you know, what you need to do is also have reforms and deep fundamental reforms, not token reforms, in the political system in order to achieve all this. Look, a socialist America would have to be much more democratic than it is now. And democracy favors the working class because it's the majority. Democracy, more majority, simple majority rule and the institutions, right, than we have today. Immediate reforms under socialism would have to occur on the political side. You get rid of Citizens United immediately, of course. Get big money out of the elections. Have all elections no more than 90 days, publicly funded, right? Open voting, as we have now in some cases, because of COVID, you know. The one positive thing about COVID, it made a mail-in ballot and easier voting inevitable. You know, Republicans and corporations had resisted mail-in voting and other measures we've seen over the past year with tooth and nail. They resisted it, but they couldn't during the crisis. And now it's become a practice, and they're going to have a hard time rolling that back. But they're trying like hell. You know, we got all this voter suppression going on and all the gerrymandering going on. That's still there. Well, you know, we get rid of voter suppression. We have federal, national voting rules and regulations that everywhere have to implement. That would be national election rules, right? Part of a socialist America, right? Obviously, we abolish the filibuster, right? We eliminate voter suppression in all forms immediately. We stop this revolving doors, you know, where people come from the corporations and they come into government agencies and the bureaucracy and they do the dirty work, get things passed, and then they go back to corporations. A good example was, I forget her name, this woman who come from the health insurance industry, Kraft's Obama's Affordable Care Act, which is a big subsidy for health insurance companies, and then she leaves and goes back to corporations. That's going on all the time in all these agencies, whether it's the Defense Pentagon or the Federal Reserve Bank or whatever, revolving doors, big problem. Well, you just make, you know, under socialism, the rule would be if you work for the government, you can't go back. You can't go back to the corporation or corporations you left, and vice versa. So these are immediate, day one reforms that would have to be passed. The War Powers Act would have to be stripped here. immediate. But beyond these immediate measures, there'd have to be some fundamental changes in the political institutions, right? Well, let's look at those. And we would have to have at least three or four amendments to the Constitution to change these institutions, right? Because the way they're structured now favors the capitalist class, you see. There's a lot of checks and balances and rules and how they proceed and everything to thwart and blunt and eliminate popular measures from below, you know. And that's what would have to change. You know, right now, the U.S. House of Representatives where the popular expressions occur from the people into the into the political government institutions, demands and so forth take hold, you know, the House of Representatives is checked, quote, by the Senate, right, and the courts. They call this checks and balances, and all that's supposed to be good. No, it's all designed to check popular demands and popular movements. You don't have that in a parliamentary system, you see. You don't have those checks and balances. Think of checks and balances as checks on the people, right, and imbalances in favor of the elites. That's what checks and balances are really about, right? You know, it's very interesting that we've got, 415 people, 435 in the House of Representatives, 435 representatives, all but 50 of which are in safe gerrymandered constituencies now because of all the gerrymandering that's been going on. And you get the, you know, almost gridlock within the House, not to mention between the House and the Senate as a result. But people don't realize that the Constitution calls for an increase in number of representatives as the population grows. We haven't increased the number of representatives in the House since 1913. Yeah. I mean, you want to overcome some of this small red state dominance in the institutions? Well, just implement the U.S. Constitution and add more people in the more populous areas, the urban areas of the country. And that would eliminate all this gerrymandering. Well, they do that still, too. You got to end the gerrymandering in the process, right? So, you know, you would have to add representatives as part of socialism into the House, get rid of all the gerrymandering. You know, one way would be to say, okay, all House districts have to have a geographic structure so that you would have at least three 90-degree definitions of the district. In other words, you look at the gerrymandering and you get some of these really weird snake-like looking districts that are gerrymandered to be safe, you know, for Republicans and the Democrats too, right? But if you said, okay, we're going to have, they're going to be almost square-like, you know, you can have a little deviation from the square, you can have two or three corners of the geographic area for the district have to be, right angles, right? That would eliminate the gerrymandering, right? I would add that you have a direct election of the U.S. president. Get rid of the Electoral College. You know, that was a big check on the will of the people, right? And not only the Electoral College, because what happened last December was pretty clear that even the Electoral College, if it turned out that the electors came, voted in favor, according to their states, in favor of a certain politician, the elites could even bypass the Electoral College. We saw that, right? We saw that under Trump, that he tried to get the governors to simply not recognize the electors or get the electors to vote different than the people in the state voted. You see, they can get around Electoral College. They use the Electoral College when it suits them, but they can get around it. They can also even get around getting around because the House of Representatives has to vote to accept the electors, right? And the vote in the House of Representatives is not based on population. It's based upon one vote for each state. Yeah, so if you control a lot of small states, right? You can overturn the popular election for the president. In other words, the people vote for the president, but the electors can do what they want. The governors of the states can refuse the electors' decisions, and then the representatives, if there's enough of them in the House, can refuse what the governors and the electors did. In other words, there's layers and layers of ways of getting around the system. If you don't like the elite, capitalist elite, if you don't like who won the popular election, do you really think that if Sanders had won the popular election, he would be sitting as president today? No. I mean, he's not a radical, right? He's a New Deal, FDR type guy, right? But they don't even want that nowadays. No. You would have seen the electors change their positions, or the governors in the red states refused to accept the electors and sent their own buddies to vote in Congress, or you would have seen the House of Representatives vote differently on ratifying the electors or the election. That's all got to change, you see. I mean, the emperor got stripped of his clothes here in December. People now see not only how the Electoral College actually functions, but how they can get around the Electoral College if they want. You see, they have all these checks and balances everywhere, and people don't even know some of them. That's got to go. That's got to go. The House of Representatives under socialism would operate more like a parliament, right? You would strip the power of the Senate to refuse the votes that come out of the House, right? Certainly, immediately, the filibuster would be gone. Holding up appointments here by cabinet members and judges, holding up the appointments of judges. You see, they put that in the Senate, right, to make sure that you get a judiciary that's as conservative as the Senate might be. Another check and balance, right? So you'd have to ban all corporate lobbying. 90-day elections, no corporate lobbying. Get rid of the lobbyists under socialism, that's for sure. All right. Maybe the Senate's term should be reduced to 4 years as well. That's another possibility, right? Get rid of revolving doors, right? But certainly the relationship of political power between House and Senate would change, and it would be more democratic. Every 2 years, you elect the people in the House, and therefore the policies would reflect more the desires and demands of the American people, and you'd have fewer of these checks and balances. What about the Supreme Court? Oh, here's another one that's really a good one. The Supreme Court is considered one of the three equal branches of government. Well, it was never intended that way under the Constitution. Constitution convention proceedings refuse to establish the Supreme Court, refused to establish a judiciary. It left it to the first administration, the Washington Adams administration, which was very conservative, by the way, really economically run by Hamilton, right? Treasury Secretary, he ran the economy. We created a judiciary. There was federal district courts and appeals courts and a Supreme Court. But even that first legislation, after the Constitution was passed, it did not give the power to declare a law passed by Congress unconstitutional. The Supreme Court did not have the power to declare constitutionality. That was usurped in 1803 by Chief Justice Marshall, who was an appointee of John Adams, very pro-business type. Adams loses the 1800 election to Jefferson, which was kind of a popular uprising here of yeoman farmers and small business and so forth, right? Jefferson comes into power, but before he leaves, he salts the Supreme Court with his appointees, including, I think it was the Secretary of State, which was John Marshall. And Marshall's purpose was, and all the other appointments that were made by Adams in the last minute before he left, the purpose of which was to check and stop whatever progressive measures the Jeffersonians might implement. That was the role of Marshall. And Marshall declared he had the right declare laws unconstitutional. In other words, whatever Jefferson might pass, that was a way of trying to stop Jefferson. That's when Supreme Court assumed this power of declaring a law constitutional. It usurped the power. It doesn't have the power in the Constitution to do that, right? It's after the Civil War. When democracy was expanded somewhat, the Supreme Court really started on this constitutionality, declaring things unconstitutional to stop the popular legislative people from below demands and measures. That's the role of the Supreme Court. Look at what's been happening with the Supreme Court in the last two decades. Supreme Court intervenes and selects George W. Bush as president. Supreme Court did that. Well, these are lifetime appointees. These aren't people who are, responsible and to the electorate at large. They intervened, and ever since then they've been intervening with Citizens United and all those laws, giving big corporations the right to have even more power in the electoral process. Right? Supreme Court. Rules that corporate business spending is free speech. Before that, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations were people and therefore had coverage under the Bill of Rights. Yeah, they're people, right? And that spending their money is free speech. Well, that's what Citizens United is about. Well, that's just made possible by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has made all the gerrymandering possible. Giving its blessing to all of these moves, by the red states to gerrymandering their districts so they control a majority of the smaller states. That's the Supreme Court. They've done that, right? What about voter suppression? Yeah, they've given their green light to voter suppression here, especially in recent years. They just about stripped the Voting Rights Act in 1965 destroyed that. This is the Supreme Court. Oh, equal branch of government. No, nothing in the Constitution says that. Well, we got to make big changes in the Supreme Court under socialism, right? First of all, they don't get lifetime appointments. At most, maybe a dozen years, right? At most, right? And maybe even we have some of them elected. That's the way the Federal Reserve was. They had to introduce governors into the Federal Reserve in the 1930s because the Federal Reserve blew it and played a big role in the Depression of the 1930s. So major constitutional amendments to change the role of the Supreme Court and to change the relative power of the U.S. Senate, right? Simple majority vote should be the rule here. And we shouldn't have to change the Constitution with 3/4 of the states, right? And we need to abolish the Electoral College. These are all measures here that would have to occur in a series of amendments, maybe 3 or 4 amendments to the Constitution itself. And the whole process of amending the Constitution has to be made more responsive here. An amendment would be direct election of the president as you throw out and eliminate the Electoral College, right? Direct election, one person, one vote, here would have to occur in the executive branch. So, you know, you tame the Supreme Court, you know, back to what it was intended. You make direct election of the president, and you eliminate these powers in the Senate to obstruct the measures that come out of the House. You make the House more like a parliament, more like a parliament. Civil liberties would have to be improved. You know, we've seen a atrophying of civil liberties ever since 2001, the Patriot Act, which has never really been abolished, right? FISA courts, you know, spying on citizens. Make spying an automatic felony. You know, any corporation or government agency that spies on the people, felony, go to jail, right? Second Amendment, there's no need for people to run around with body armor and machine guns, right? You can have your guns, right? But the era of machine guns should be eliminated. This doesn't require constitutional moves. Well, you could amend and clarify the Second Amendment to the Constitution. You know, immediately pass the Equal Rights Amendment, right? Eliminate free speech, corporate rights here under the Citizens United, right? And also expand democracy in different ways. The Federal Reserve, for example, should have a majority of its governors elected at large. I mean, why do you have so much power in the hands of 19 people who run the Federal Reserve? Actually, seven to nine of them actually run the Federal Reserve, you see. You got an open market committee composed of rotating district Fed presidents, and then you have the governors and a chair and a vice chair. Well, these people aren't elected. They're not accountable. And the Fed itself is not accountable to the country at large, although it has a big impact on the country at large. It's only accountable to the bankers. Well, that's got to change. We got to democratize the Fed, that's for sure. And then, you know, democracy would be greatly expanded by creating these works councils at the local level. You know, equal representation of the community and the workers themselves on the boards of their companies, and on each location, works committees that would oversee the decisions of the professional managers. You know, it's not as if your local assembly worker would be making decisions on what to invest in financially in the company. No, you have professionals that do that. But the Works Council has the right to all the information for the decisions, and the right to veto. The right to veto the decisions. That's what a Works Council would do. Wouldn't run and manage the company. You know, maybe in a little longer term, workers can get, you know, more sophisticated in their running of the company at the local level, and they probably would. But initially, you know, Socialist America would have to have the structure of works councils on the boards and in the companies themselves. And that's democracy. You see, that's industrial economic democracy. That's an expansion of democracy into the economic sphere. So, you know, to summarize, immediate reforms, day one that I talked about, a restructuring of the elections process. You get rid of certain things that are obstacles, right, and there to protect the elite, the capitalist elite. You make the U.S. House more like a parliamentary body. You break the power of the Senate to thwart the decisions and the, you know, demands of the people. You break the power of the Supreme Court, right? And you make the president direct elected. These are things structurally, politically, that a socialist America would have to implement and what it would look like, along with the economic changes that I described earlier and last week. Okay, we're out of here.